Cedric Muhammad.
Now here's the second question I got. Cedric, do you think the policy of relying on foreign-trained health workers is a net harm or a net help to developing countries? For example, the brain drain that these countries experience versus the remittances that they receive from the people who have left. Now listen, all the Africa-concerned individuals that listen to my show, just listen to what I'm about to say. This person asked me, for example, Cedric, there are more Ethiopian physicians in Chicago than in all of Ethiopia, a country of 80 million. I have a colleague who calls this skill flow and sees it as a net positive because skilled labor is moving to where it can be quote unquote most productive. Cedric, do you think the health sector is different from the IT or the engineering sector in this respect? Do you feel differently about privately trained foreign health workers versus publicly trained health workers who represent a much greater loss of public subsidy? I'm trying to explain to you all why there's in every region of the world you have migrant workers leaving one country going to another. It's not an accident. It's a long answer I gave. Let me just give you all part of this answer. I said if I had to choose, I believe it is a net harm because human capital is the most valuable of all. And when it is not developed and not financed, death and poverty are the result. But it is not being developed and financed for reasons beyond U.S. and domestic policies. There is more that needs to be considered, such as the disincentive of leaders in quote-unquote developing countries to make long-term economic decisions like developing a national healthcare system or economic reforms that would allow a private sector, indigenous and foreign, to produce one. This is a good question because it reveals again that not just the United States is schizophrenic about whether or not there exist any closed economies other than the world itself. Multilateral and international institutions, which now dominate the economic policy debate of least developed countries, LDCs, and domestic nation-state units, make policies that are irreconcilable and uncoordinated. The decision-making is not transparent and there is not real public debate over what constitutes a closed economy. And the real limitations of what an LDC, a least developed country, can do in a global economy. An LDC has no independent monetary policy and it is not allowed an independent trade or industrialization policy due to the WTO and EPA Economic Partnership Agreement like entanglements, debt burdens, and conditionality imposed by the IMF, World Bank, or creditor nations and financial markets strip them of this. They all combine and even conspire to produce export-driven commodities, export-driven commodity-based economies without the specialization and financial innovation that could produce a real medical system. Leaders take advantage of this while they and their people simultaneously benefit and are harmed by it. That is at the real root of the global immigration debate. Is it by design or accident that people are leaving their countries for jobs elsewhere? The limited American-Mexico immigration debate is a classic example. Why it may be easy to see that Mexican leaders like Vicente Fox actually wanted Mexican workers to leave the country to get jobs in America so they can send money back home in the form of remittances. Why? Because besides the obvious lack of economic development, every developing country needs foreign currency in U.S. dollars to finance its imports. Look as Cuba, Venezuela, and Iran struggle with this today. But what most observers don't realize is that the same relationship that the United States has with Mexico, Mexico has with Guatemala. Mexico itself has a migrant worker program for Guatemalan migrant workers in the Mexican state of Chiapas. And Guatemalan migrants are registered as employees on farms within the Mexican state of Chiapas on coffee, sugarcane, papaya, plantain farms, etc. They are permitted multiple entries and exits into Mexico, but their movement is limited to within the state of Chiapas. On average, over the last decade, over 40,000 of these agricultural visitors rotate like this each year. Yugoslavia's Marshal Tito pioneered this strategy in the 1970s, sending 11% of the Yugoslav workforce into Western Europe. The remittances that they sent back home equaled 30% of the country's exports. This is what I'm saying about Michael Moore's movie. It does a good job of highlighting a problem, but it does not really point you in the direction of the real revolutionary democratic or political force that you would need to change things. The realistic and radical solutions to solve something like the immigration issue, which has impacted this healthcare debate, as you all know, you can't get that through a two-party system. So let me finish this. The remittances that were sent back home equal 30% of Yugoslavia's exports. When countries are incapable of developing their economies so that they produce domestic jobs, they export their labor force. This works hand in hand with the corporate interests of so-called developed economies, who skillfully make arguments that in certain industries there are not enough qualified workers to fill needed positions. They lobby Congress in search of the policies that they desire, and the nationals and immigrants that are based in America and which represent voting blocks for members of Congress also fight for immigration policies that will allow more to arrive from the homeland. By the way, few seem to realize the role that chain migration, enabled by Congress's decision since 1957 to allow each immigrant admitted to subsequently petition for the admission of their parents, siblings, and their families, and adult children and their families, plays in creating constituencies that influence visa policy for foreign healthcare workers. Now, I could go on. I just wanted to drop some light on the global migrant worker conspiracy. Now, what is that? Capitalism? If that's the case, there's complicity in non-capitalist countries. The socialist and communist countries are willfully accepting or actually encouraging people to leave their country to go work abroad. So that's not really a capitalistic conspiracy. You've got communist and socialist influenced governments or states planning their economies in a way that facilitates this. So let's end the capitalism-socialism thing. Let me read your comments. I'm a little back up. Wayne from Delran, New Jersey, Route 130 into his house. Wayne says, can we buy the books at the bookstore or only online? They may be, Wayne, the books may be in some bookstores now, but initially the distribution, which is even in England, my book is available on in the UK. It's online initially. I believe within a month or so, you'll see it in actual bookstores. So you can go into an Amazon or Barnes & Noble and request it, and they'll order it, no problem. We had a great first week. Book sales on Amazon.com. Our ranking shot through the roof. So soon, Wayne. But for now, if it's not an inconvenience, order the book through Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, The Entrepreneurial Secret, my book. Brother Kevin from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, he says, I just got in, brother. Yes, sir. I thought it was very disrespectful how they, on the VH1 Awards, did EPMD, even Ghostface too. They also could have thrown in Kay Solo in the mix as well. Rod Ginyard has a comment from Shark Tank. He says the chill soda vendor was extremely lucky to get the offer from Barbara, since the beverage business would seem to be the most difficult nut to crack. She must have been some kind of niche market for it, in the hopes of being absorbed by one of the conglomerates in the future. Good idea, but very, very risky. Cameron from New Jersey, Patterson, he says the clothing woman wants to open a store in that area to take advantage of her popularity in that region. The model she is using is dated and clouding her judgment. Said, where will we be able to get our copies of your book signed? Should we just run up on you on U Street? That would work. Anyone runs up on me with my book, I'm going to sign it. Now, we may offer let me test the market for this. Would you all be interested in a special edition hardback single volume signed copy? Whole book in one, all three volumes in a hardbound signed. If there's a market for that, then we'll do that. But as for right now, you would just have to forge my signature or run up on me. Man, I got a lot of stuff. Let me make this point about President Obama and the satanic and angelic forces that are fighting over him. There was an article in last week's Wall Street Journal. It says, behind Afghan war debate, a battle of two books rages. Now, in November, we like to do JFK talk, but I'm going to kind of modify it I really think that President Obama is in a similar situation regarding Afghanistan as JFK was with Vietnam early in his presidency. Some of you may agree, you may disagree. But I would like to invite anyone who wants to do that kind of a study or dialogue with me. We can start in November. There's a couple books you can read. The Wall Street Journal wrote an article saying that the Obama administration is debating what to do on Afghanistan in the context of these two books. Article is Behind Afghan War Debate, A Battle of Two Books Rages. The struggle to set the future course of the Afghan war is becoming a battle of two books, both suddenly popular among White House and Pentagon brain trusts. The two draw decidedly different lessons from the Vietnam War. The first book describes the White House in 1965 being marched into an escalating war by a military, viewing the conflict too narrowly to see the perils ahead. President Barack Obama recently finished the book, according to administration officials, and Vice President Joe Biden is reading it now. The second describes a different administration in 1972, when a U.S. military that has finally figured out how to counter the insurgency is rejected by political leaders who bow to popular opinion and end the fight. It has been recommended in multiple lists, but put out by military officers, including a former U.S. commander in Afghanistan, who passed it out to his subordinates. The two books, one called Lessons in Disaster on Mr. Obama's Nightstand, and the second, A Better War on the Shelves of Military Gurus, have become a framework for the debate over what will be one of the most important decisions of Mr. Obama's presidency. On Tuesday, in a White House meeting that went well over its allotted hour, Mr. Obama discussed the war with 31 members of Congress, Republican leaders, and some Democrats pressed him to quickly accept the judgment of his commanders and send as many as 40,000 additional troops to Afghanistan, but some Democrats asked if the war was winnable. Lessons in Disaster entered the West Wing circulation after Deputy National Security Advisor Tom Donilon, one of the top foreign policy voices in the White House, gave it to the White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel after reading it himself. Mr. Emanuel read the book in a weekend and then showed it to the president, who was already working on his own copy. Instead, Mr. Emanuel gave his copy to senior White House advisor David Axelrod, according to an administration official familiar with the book's path. Once in Mr. Obama's hands, the book drew attention throughout the administration's foreign policy ranks. There are striking similarities between the debates of today and yesteryear. Now, as in the 1960s, the discussion in the administration is how to best defeat a perceived national security threat. In both periods, the U.S. had partnered with corrupt governments with tainted leaders. Okay, Lessons in Disaster. Cop that book. The other book is called A Better War. Let me read this article on Chinatown I've been trying to get to. Wall Street Journal, October 8th, 2009. Now, this is what I'm saying. We're getting caught up in a false argument. If you want to know how wealth is built at a neighborhood and community level, leave capitalism and communism alone and look at ethnic communities like the Chinese and the Jewish community. This is from Wall Street Journal last week. From Chinatown to every town. It's talking about the Museum of Chinese in America. Says here, the relocated and newly designed Museum of Chinese in America held its formal opening on September 22nd, displaying an ambitious exhibit called With a Single Step, Stories in the Making of America. This was a landmark occasion for the museum, which was founded in 1980 as a project to collect historical information and artifacts about New York's Chinatown. While marking the opening of the new location in Chinatown's northern limits, the museum also celebrates the story of the emergence of Chinese Americans into the mainstream of American life, thus extending the museum's scope beyond Chinatown and into the national realm. I'll give you some more elements here. In many ways, the Chinese American story reflects that of other immigrant groups in America. However, a deeper inquiry reveals many aspects that are unique to the Chinese. From the early days of the gold fields of California, their circumstances created an unusually insular and defensive ethnic community. man, go tell somebody I'm talking about Chinatown, how they did this thing. Later for the capitalism, socialism stuff, man. I'm talking about how the Chinese built wealth in America, built their community up. Man, somebody needs to do a movie on this. Well, maybe they did already. I need to get a late pass. From the early days in the gold fields of California, their circumstances created an unusually insular and defensive ethnic community. Chinese came as sojourners and were expected to return to their homeland. Damn, that's it right there. There was an expectation for them to come back home. Well, we didn't have that in terms of Africa, but we can recreate that. Those who stayed, and that, let me just say this, a departure. That really is what the minister is doing. I think some people want the minister to set up like 5,000 banks or, 80,000 businesses. Well, he kind of has done that in a more spiritual context. The program, or I would say the part of the assignment that he has to a degree in this area is spiritual transformation of individuals who would then be the building blocks like a body coming together perfectly to form an economy. It's really not the minister's job to build the economy himself. He's a convener. He's like a magnet. He pulls everybody. Everybody is attracted to him. Boom. Then the people have to be arranged. So you can help him out by arranging yourself. And as I say, some people, you know, the Million Man March did not live up to expectations. I've heard this, I don't know how long. And I just remind people, the Million Man March was the result in large part of 400 local organizing committees. In 400 cities and towns, essentially, there were LOCs, local organizing communities, that helped to plan the logistics, the promotion, and the execution of the Million Man March. Well, the LOCs were the basis of community development. Those groups never had to break up. I think within 1 year, there were only two left that were active. You can't blame that on the minister. Okay, back to the article. Those who stayed, talking about the Chinese, were denied citizenship under the naturalization laws of the time. Their presence raised the ire of white working class elements, and the result was the first American law to specifically exclude a racial or ethnic group, the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. The act excluded working class Chinese, which, while allowing merchants, teachers, and tourists to enter. This aspect of Chinese American history is amply documented with photographs of Chinese American life and by documents produced by their adversaries. There thus developed demographically a highly unusual ethnic community. The overall number of foreign-born Chinese steadily declined, even though there were many illegal immigrants who eluded the exclusion law or entered on falsified documents. Those born in America were citizens under the terms of the 14th Amendment and had civil rights that their parents did not have. At all times, there was a severe imbalance between men and women, about 20-1, damn, toward the end of the 19th century. The number of minor children was small and the normal family life was practically impossible. The result was an inbred and culturally stagnant community. The Chinese communities also harbored many internal conflicts between dominant merchants and other classes among immigrants from various regions in China and among rival community organizations. Conflict was intensified with the outbreak of the Civil War in China. Beginning in the late 1920s, there were supporters of both sides of the America Chinatowns. The tensions abated while the Chinese united to defeat the Japanese, but they broke out once more when the Civil War renewed and the communists took over the mainland. You can go to any Chinatown today and see the remnants of its history. Chapter 3 of my book, so important. It deals with kinship systems and group economics. So important. I explain exactly what it was that the Chinese did to back entrepreneurs. It's something you can do right now. We just don't want to do it. Let me put some jazz on you. Let me smooth it out with the jazz. This is my main man, Donald Byrd, the most underrated legend. Speak to him, Donald. I think Donald Byrd had a song. Who made the song Chinatown? Was that Donald Byrd? For those of you that don't know, I'm trying to get reparations for Long Island and Queens. Long Island and Queens disrespected in the hip-hop world. Look at all that they've given. Public Enemy, Rakim, 50 Cent, LL Cool J, Run DMC. Queens and Long Island. There's only one way to honor Long Island. I salute you today. You're about to have a nervous breakdown. If you're in Long Island right now, you can wig out at work. All EPMD supporters, Rakim, 50 Cent, G-Unit, Lost Boys, anybody in Queens and Long Island, I'm gonna get us reparations.
Listen to the situation, my son. I'm as serious as cancer, all fun and done. For the time, the group of course bumped the rhymes to his ballad. The best you will find.
Living in CI, who the hell am I? DJ Rock the juice, I can fly cool with the riffing guy. Keep a handle, cause if you don't, I'll wax it down like a candle.
Be love, I'm a top villa. Part-time killer, permanent chiller. Son of Sam Killer, the horror in the villa. Unlike the rest, the best, I am a thriller.
Kill it or shoot it, bite it and distribute it. But either way, the truth unconstituted. Styling and wilding con.
Please, tell Long Island what I'm doing right now.
You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
Listen to the situation, my son. I'm as serious as cancer, all fun and done. For the time, the group of course bumped the rhymes to his ballad. The best you will find.
Living in CI, who the hell am I? DJ Rock the juice, I can fly cool with the riffing guy. Keep a handle, cause if you don't, I'll wax it down like a candle.
Be love, I'm a top villa. Part-time killer, permanent chiller. Son of Sam Killer, the horror in the villa. Unlike the rest, the best, I am a thriller.
Kill it or shoot it, bite it and distribute it. But either way, the truth's unconstituted. Styling and wilding, constantly smiling. We'll keep trooping in a place called Strong Island.
To protect, I'm here to meet that dissect. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, but now Long Island effect.
That's word to her.
It's about out east. We got the talent eating it up like a Sunday feast.
Hear from the doctor, go get the priest. Cause as of now, MCs should cease. Straight from the mic, all trouble release. You wanna scratch like a cake, I'll dish you a piece.
I need a scratch, now my battery's banging. Sorry for the pause, didn't mean to leave you hanging. I'm good to go, so let you know my words flow. I got the voice that's choice, kicking in this demo.
Getting fully, fully paid with my man Andrew Jackson. My bank accountant Ben Franklin did some action. So I sit in court, while my 50s I sort. Once in a while I lounge about in the gear that I brought.
Taking daily shopping sprees with major credit cards. Buying up with false disregard. Money ain't the object cause I got it to fling. My lower class is well the valley and the upper's just king.
Step up on the platform, kid, if you're so irate. We complete with the feet, it's not added or fake. Test your skills, if you will, don't let us trouble your face. But the almighty JVC force, the boys with some great Strong Island.
Sobering, stimulating, and hot. It's the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Program. Cedric Muhammad.
I have a short time to deal with this enormous subject. And I beg you, therefore, to weigh my words with the attention and thought which I have given to them. Many people think that the best way to escape war is to dwell upon its horrors and to imprint them vividly upon the minds of the younger generation. They flaunt the grisly photographs before their eyes. They fill their ears with tales of carnage. They dilate upon the ineptitude of generals and admirals. They denounce the crime and insensate folly of human strife. Now, all this teaching ought to be very useful in preventing us from attacking or invading any other country, if anyone outside a madhouse wished to do so. But how would it help us if we were attacked or invaded ourselves? That is the question we have to ask.
Cedric Muhammad.
Jay. Yo, what's up, Trav?
What's up, Sad Man?
Come on, man. He's ready to get busy.
Oh, yo, Chilly.
You know what? I like this beat you brought.
Yo, told you about it.
You know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna take it into my ultra laboratory.
Work with
hook
it, man.
It up.
Hook
yo,
it up.
Bust this.
Cedric Muhammad.
Oh, I tell ya, boy.
We are nerds. This is so funky that we're sending both back to the turntable. And you gonna follow the rest of the time.
Quick, yo, get it now.
And we're gonna do this. It's funky. I know you
wanna
like
it. Oh, yeah. Like you know that.
Cedric Muhammad. It's the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee program. The Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Program.
Now more of our rare and exclusive interview with conservative radio host Rush Limbaugh. This morning, his thoughts on his past addiction to painkillers and some of the most powerful names in politics. He sat down with Today National correspondent Jamie Gangel. Jamie, good morning to you.
Matt, good morning. Get ready. Here it is, what Rush really thinks about everyone from Sarah Palin to Hillary Clinton, what he would say if President Obama invited him to the White House, and why he says his struggle with addiction is actually the best thing that ever happened to him. But we started by asking his thoughts on the next president race. Give me your top three picks for who will be the Republican.
I have no idea. I'm certainly not in charge of picking them. The only thing I could do is recite names from 2008 that probably won't back in it. Sarah Palin, Mitt Romney, Huckabee, Tim Pawlenty is probably going to go in. Mm. But at this stage, as the anointer of the Republican nominee, I'm not going to go out there now and destroy the chances of three or four other people.
Oh.
I have more compassion than that.
Do you think the Republicans can win?
Yes.
Do you think they will win?
Too soon to say, but I think it's entirely possible. We do have Obama, and he is truly polarizing the country. So there will be a significant vote against, but you got to have somebody to vote for at the same time.
If he invited you to the White House, would you go?
Absolutely.
And what would you say to him?
Well, it depends on what he wanted me there for.
Well, if you want to sit at the picnic table and make up.
Have a beer?
Less polarizing, more unity.
I'd be honest with him. The President of the United States, President of the United States, is my president too. I want this country to succeed. And if he invited me up there to chat, I would owe him the dignity and honor of being honest.
Never one to hold back.
This is a joke of an administration, except it's very, very real.
We asked Rush to play word association. I say President Obama, you say...
Disaster.
Michelle Obama.
Garden.
Garden.
Yeah, there's plants of garden out there.
Jimmy Carter.
An utter disgrace and embarrassment. Sorry for the four words, but I needed them all.
Sarah Palin.
Misunderstood and underestimated.
You love her.
Well, no. Love. I admire her. People have tried to destroy her. She's got more of a backbone than any man in the Democrat Party.
George W. Bush.
He's just the most decent, down-to-earth, real man you could ever hope to meet.
Glenn Beck. Do you worry about the new guy on the block?
No. 1988, I'm the only national conservative voice. Now look at conservative media. Look what I have spawned.